Today, we're going to continue with our discussion of entropy and thermodynamics, but we're going to do this from a much more practical standpoint. So at the beginning of the notes, I have an equation that I've been previewing at different times in the quarter, or if you don't recall the equation, this delta G you've seen several times already in the quarter. What this is related to is the second law of thermodynamics, which simply stated says that any spontaneous process, any process that is likely to happen without the outside input of energy, always creates increased entropy, whether that is for the system itself or the surroundings. So there's this discussion of systems surrounding the universe. That's the last bit of theory. That's the hardest bit. That's what we're going to do last. Because if it's the one thing that you don't get this quarter, you'll still survive in the future. But at least let me write down what I just said about the second law. And there's the sloppy way and the more detailed way to say it. Second law of thermodynamics. The short one is entropy always increases. The better way to say it is a spontaneous process one that does not require outside energy must cause an increase in entropy when both the systems and surroundings are taken into account. So last time I mentioned this, you can't win, you can't break even metaphor for the first and second law of thermodynamics. And you can't win. You can't create energy from nothing. In an isolated system, the overall energy change is zero. There's then the sneaky wit, which is that it doesn't mean you can't have things happen, it's just the total energy change has to add up to zero. The second law of thermodynamics predicts the reaction direction, which the first law can't do. The first law can't say, why doesn't ice just, buzzword, spontaneously freeze? And it's because the second law says anything that's going to happen on its own has to increase entropy. That's the only way that something will spontaneously happen. So I have this equation I wrote up above, which let me just move it below so I have more room to do things with it. The theory part that we still need to cover justifies this equation. This was part of the light bulb moment that maybe I was describing. If I didn't babble about this already, and even if I did, you can't stop me. I remember a couple of quarters back talking with Professor Brophy just how much I disliked teaching the entropy chapter because, in my words, I just didn't get it. And you might thinking, that's very comforting, Dr. Gray, that you're a chemistry instructor and you're saying, yeah, but you know, it's just like quantum mechanics. I think it was Feinstein that said you never really understand it. You just get used to it. And so you can get used to a topic and explain it and make people go, oh, okay. But then you don't remember where the hell anything came from. And that's the way I was with this equation. And I finally got it. It's like the words that I've been reading, it's like, no, I get it. The thing on the left, this is what's known as the Gibbs function, or what I'm going to call free energy, which, again, to be a little sloppy, it is the available potential energy. In other words, it's how much work can be done. And thinking of potential, next quarter, delta G, you're going to equate to voltage. So yeah, that's going to be a fun discussion too. So anyways, one of these terms has to do with the system itself, and one of these has to do with the surroundings. So this is the system, and this is the surroundings. Which means you add the system and surroundings around, you get the universe. So the whole point of saying free energy is that it depends on the entropy change of the universe. Now, what's the practicality of this equation? So I'd like to give you a very specific example that I think I touched on last time with a different substance. The reason for explaining this example in the level of detail that I'm going to is to give you some easy points on an exam, because especially with it being open notes, it's not going to be too hard to answer some of these questions. And that's actually partly why I did it in past quarters, because just to give you a heads up and not to lose the thought, beast, yeah. So, I told you, cartoon voice trapped in a chemistry instructor. You're going to have to do pH and Ka calculations on the third exam, like the problems we've been doing all this time with acids and bases, and that part's going to hurt. And maybe we'll practice a little bit on Friday. And it's not going to hurt because I'm trying. It's because nobody ever does enough practice. Year after year, I say, do it. And yeah. So, I really did lose that thought. Hold on. The thought is this. This is a very specific problem that gets at delta H and delta S and delta G. It explains what these creatures are in this equation. The whole point of this equation is that it's equivalent to energy. And so that's why if you go back and look at all the equilibrium diagrams, anytime I had delta E or I had E, I might have snuck in a delta G. Why? Because delta H by itself, how much heat is moving around, doesn't take into effect this effect of entropy. So you got to take entropy into account. And sometimes entropy can help a reaction happen that shouldn't. And sometimes entropy will prevent a reaction that looks like it should happen. So that's why this specific example. The big lead up is I don't remember if this example is any one specific place, or I might be pulling pieces from different parts of different chapters. But it's open notes, so here we go. Before I get into the example, let me remind you that since we're talking about potential energy, what does that mean in terms of being positive or negative? Which, by the way, I guess I never did a very good job of specifically saying, what does increase in entropy mean? Like, what is delta S greater than zero means? It means more disorder. There's no better word without getting too fancy. So more disorder, which is favorable. Remember, for delta H, a negative value is favorable. For delta S, a positive value is favorable. So now if delta S is negative, then it means more order, which is not statistically likely, which is why it's unfavorable. So putting delta H with delta S, we get delta G. If delta G is less than zero, then the word we use is exergonic. And the buzzword that goes with it is spontaneous. In other words, it's one of these reactions that is favorable to happen. If delta G is greater than zero, it is endergonic, which means non-spontaneous. which means it requires outside energy. Again, with the imprecision, what does it mean when delta G is equal to zero? In many cases, it means equilibrium. What? Well, remember, equilibrium, that's that lowest point on the curve. You know that picture that I've been trying to program you with for weeks now? So when we finally start talking about energy formally, I can just connect the two. So delta G is potential energy, which means it takes everything going on in the reaction into account. And so you have one nice number that tells you, will the reaction happen or not? If that number is negative, it means, yes, it's going to go downhill in energy. If it's positive, that means it's gone too far. It's actually going to want to go backwards if possible. In order to push it forwards, you have to do exactly that. You have to add energy in. Delta G equal to zero can mean different things. But a definition of equilibrium is that you have no change in the energy of the system because you have no change in the concentrations of the system. And since all the concentrations of all the components in the system are what define potential energy anyways, then in the case of equilibrium, delta G is going to be equal to zero. Now, let's talk about different combinations of delta H and delta S that give us this spontaneous reaction. Questions before we move to the next page. I miss Brophy. Yeah, I know. I'm outclassed sometimes. Is that T delta S? Yes. Whoa. What happened to my eraser? Got too big. Hold on. There we go. So let's move on to the next page then, where I'm going to take this same equation and have some examples. Let's see. What's a really simple one? You know, I can't think of the one. I'm trying to think of something where delta H is automatically negative in a way that you would obviously recognize, and that delta S is also positive in a way that you would automatically recognize. And I know there's a molecule out there that's the perfect example, and I suddenly went blank. So let me talk about this example that's going to be on the exam. Did I say that out loud? This very traditional problem I always talk about. The process of ammonium nitrate reacting or dissolving in water to become an aqueous solution. And the important thing about this is that delta H is greater than zero. Is there any way we can explain why it's greater than zero? Yes. Because imagine a two-step process. Imagine if we had ammonium nitrate solid. What would happen if we added enough energy to completely separate all of the ions? What kind of phase of matter would exist? Gas, that's exactly right. Because what type of substance is ammonium nitrate? And, you know, I've been so focused on getting through this course, hoping that any of this is making any sense without us being present together. But you know, in a classroom where you have the people that are in front, where you got your chem majors, you got your people like me, just science geeks. I said people like me, so I'm going to use the word. And you got everybody else that maybe needs to hear better, see better, whatever reasons, they're sitting in the front row. And then you got the people that are like a few rows back, and then there's a gap always. And then there's the people in the back. And they can be perfectly good students, so I'm not trying to automatically badmouth the people in the back. Maybe they're the people that are just shy, and so they don't want the instructor like, hey, you. You know, it's a little bit harder to do that when you're sitting in the back there. Or they might be the people that are too busy doing their Fortnite or something instead of doing lecture. But when I look at this computer screen, I just had this realization that you're all in the same level. You're all in the same window. So all I have to do is like point my finger and say, hey, Katie, what kind of substance is this? And then she's squirming on the other side of her screen right now, probably pretending to be AFK. But I'm just thinking for next quarter when I have to do this all over again, how to make all of us less crazy, maybe I'll give participation points for people that actually speak instead of type. Since I see everybody with a microphone here pretty much, is there anybody without a microphone? That means everybody in here is at minimum able to voice participate. The whole class just went, oh God, not now. Let's see. Does making a movie franchise? Yeah, if you get the right person to cast me. But seriously, nobody knows what ammonium nitrate is. It's not an okay. Technically, it is acidic. Yes, good. That's acceptable. But there's another definition. Okay, Chem 1A people, is it covalent or ionic?
Covalent.
Wow. No. That is an ammonium ion and a nitrate ion, which are only held together because of their positive and negative charges. And that's the whole point of pointing that out. Because when you blast them apart by adding enough energy, that means you're going to get ammonium ions in the gas phase and nitrate ions in the gas phase. And this amount of energy it takes to do it is called lattice energy. Why? Because a lattice implies a regularly ordered structure, which is what a lot of ionic compounds are. Okay, but notice that's the gas phase. So obviously that's not exactly what's going on here. The ions are going to get surrounded by water. And they're going to become an aqueous mixture. Now, last quarter, hopefully you learned what strong electrolytes are. Those are substances that completely dissociate in solution. And in fact, the fact that ammonium nitrate is so soluble is because it's a strong electrolyte. Because in order for ionic substances to dissolve in water, they must dissociate as well. This process of the ions getting surrounded by water is hydration. Now, we care more about this direct pathway between the solid and the aqueous mixture, which is the heat of solution. But what is Hess's law?
It doesn't care about how it gets there.
That's right, that whenever you know the identity of your reactants and products, how the reaction occurs does not change the amount of energy change that will occur, because the identities of the reactants and products are a state. So let me write that down. Hess's law is that the energy change in a chemical reaction does not depend at all on how the reaction occurs. Only on its reactants and products. And what that means is it doesn't matter if we went directly from a solid to a solution, which is our heat of a solution, or if we theoretically anticipated what would the energy necessarily be to completely rip the ions apart and then to allow the ions to exist in water. Doesn't matter which way we do it, we can add the two together. So in other words, the heat of solution is equal to lattice energy plus the heat of hydration. Hydration is automatically negative. And that's because ions are attracted to water. We spent a bunch of the quarter talking about how water is polar, got a little plus, a little minus. That means it can interact with ions. So hydration is automatically a negative quantity because you're bringing full positive and negatives, charges, together to water, which has these partial negatives and positives. Lattice energy is always a positive value. Because you're pulling ions apart. They were a solid, you're disrupting the solid. So this is an example of Hess's law, and this is just to say that in the case of dissolving ammonium nitrate in water, the lattice energy is greater than the heat of hydration. So the process is endothermic. Now, what does that mean? It means that the solution is going to get cold, which is exactly backwards from the type of reaction you expect to be, buzzword, spontaneous. The equation at the top of the page is what this is all related to. Because what I just said here is the heat of solution is greater than zero. So back up top here, delta H is greater than zero. A spontaneous reaction has to be one where there's an overall release of energy. So, in order for the reaction to occur, delta G must be less than zero for this to occur. So, mathematically, what is the only way this can happen? See, delta H is positive. Delta G must be negative. And the only way it can be true, only way it can happen, is if delta S is positive.
Are you writing? Because...
At the top.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So maybe I wrote this a bit backwards, but I wanted to emphasize this is an example of this equation in action. The chemical reaction is this thing dissolving. In order for, and I'll write this on the next page because this might not be a sentence you're programmed to say. In order for most ionic substances to dissolve in water, they must also dissociate in water because of the fact they're ionic compounds, that the only thing holding together as ionic solids is this set of ionic attractions. And making a solution is the process of breaking apart those attractions. So that's why in order for it to dissolve, for it to spread around in water, it has to dissociate. It has to have its bonds break. And the whole point about why this is unusual or why this should be counterintuitive is because it causes the temperature of water to drop, which means it's endothermic. This whole Hess's law discussion was to get some understanding why would it be endothermic. Because some things you throw them in water and it releases a lot of energy. Case of that would be sodium hydroxide. Sodium hydroxide releases a lot of energy when you put it into water. And so in that case, it just happens to be that its lattice energy is lower than its hydration energy. So it releases more than it absorbs. Here it's the backwards. Here it's the case what you see in the diagram there. You have a larger lattice energy and then a small benefit from hydration. So overall, this process absorbs energy. Now, going back to the equation at the top, if it absorbs energy, you should say, or you would think that it's not likely to occur. But there's this other component, entropy. And so entropy, because you make a mess, you're making a solution, you're allowing a lot more freedom of movement, a lot more possible energy states. So because of this large increase of entropy, it makes up for the fact that you have to absorb heat. So even though heat is being absorbed, overall, there's potential energy being released. And so that's why this easily dissolves in water. Let me switch pages and write a few of these things down.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
On where hydration is this just supposed to be NH plus?
No, NH4 plus. Thank you. Minus two for Dr. Gray. Okay. So one thing that I said is that in order for an ionic compound to dissolve in water, it must dissociate. The process of dissolving involves separating ions, unlike covalent compounds. That's why it's critical to know this is an ionic versus covalent compounds. Sugar, when you throw it into water, doesn't dissociate. It only dissolves. The molecules of sucrose separate from each other without sucrose reacting. But for our ionic substance, it has to react in water by dissociating. So in order for an ionic compound to dissolve in water, it must dissociate. The process of dissolving involves separating ions, unlike covalent compounds. So this automatically involves breaking ionic bonds. Which means that it dissociates. So, the whole point of this example is that, based on heat alone, forming a solution of ammonium nitrate should not be possible. Since it involves absorbing heat. But creating the solution creates disorder. Oh, wait, let me add one thing here. Sorry. Since it involves absorbing heat. So I wanted to say that delta H is greater than zero. But forming a solution involves a large increase of entropy. Because there is far more freedom of motion. So one more time, showing this equation. Delta G is equal to delta H minus T delta S. We identified that delta H is greater than zero. But we also identified that if delta S is greater than zero, then if T is large enough, which for ammonium nitrate, it is at room temperature because it dissolves at room temperature. If the temperature is high enough, the favorable effects of a positive entropy change can counter the effects of a positive enthalpy change. Making the process spontaneous, which means negative delta G. So that is the whole point of the example, showing specifically how mathematically entropy, the fact that matter and energy are being distributed, has the energetic effect of making the reaction favorable, even though it's absorbing heat. So, any questions on this example before I now talk about a few other cases? All right, then. Let me just mention in terms of problems, there is a section in the book in this chapter where it deals with calculating delta G from a table of delta H values and delta S values. And that is the classic change in energy is adding up all of the products and subtracting out all the reactants. We might get to that problem. We might not, because to me it's more of a mathematical exercise. What more matters more to me is being able to explain exactly a problem like this, that even though you have a process that absorbs heat, it can still occur. Now, there's sometimes where reaction will always happen, and that's what I was struggling to come up with earlier. And maybe this would very likely be an example. Maybe. What if we had something like propane? And propane accessories. Reacting with oxygen. Of course, there's an activation barrier. You have to light it to get it to start. But it's eventually going to create CO2, and water. Now, one propane is going to make three carbon dioxides. In fact, let's balance out the stoichiometry. Let's make this a proper reaction. So if we have, we'll have a 3 here for carbon. That'll also give us a 4 here for water, which will give us a 5 here for oxygen, right? So you start out with a total of 6 moles of gas on the left, and you end up with 7 moles of gas on the right. And so I'm going to guess that this is an increase in entropy. And there's a way to calculate it. And maybe before next lecture, and yes, it was King of the Hill. Sorry. For those of you who didn't get the propane and propane accessories, my mother still lives in a town that's not the one that's in that television series, but is 100 miles or so from it. So I resemble them too much. Anyways, I'm going to guess this is an increase in entropy. It is totally known, it's totally sure, and I could calculate it as well, that the heat of this reaction is negative. It's combustion. So again, looking at the delta G equation, if I'm correct in my guess that delta S is positive, and we know for sure that delta H is negative, well, we have a negative sign in this equation. So if you take negative a positive entropy, that means no matter what temperature, so regardless of temperature, the reaction is spontaneous. Delta G is negative. Now, I can't think of a reaction offhand. This one I'll have to go to the book. But what if you had a case where you had a positive delta H and you had a negative delta S, then regardless of temperature, the reaction is non-spontaneous. Because no matter what temperature it is, delta G, the potential energy, will always be positive. So always involves an increase in potential energy. I'm sorry, Elise, you probably had your hand up for a while now. I just saw that. You had a question.
Yeah, I had a question for the 3 and 4 moles. The water, is that liquid or gas?
Liquid if we're talking about room temperature. So even though it's combusting, mm-hmm. once you form the product, it's in its natural state at that temperature. And so water would be liquid at room temperature.
Okay, and then for the 6 and 7 moles, you're just talking about, like, total moles, right?
Because that's right. 6 moles total on the left, 7 moles total on the right. And so don't think of this like a gas problem, because water's a liquid, and so if we were doing equilibrium, this would be a more complicated discussion. But we're not talking equilibrium here. We're only talking about delta S.
Okay, and then since it's 7 moles, that's why you're assuming it's positive, right? Because there's more moles on the side?
That's my guess, yes. And I will try to see if this example or something like it is in a textbook. So not only is this an educated guess, let's find out if it's right.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
For the top of the equation, so when we put the reaction together, that means it will react the automatically, right? For the because of the delta G is less than zero.
Yes. So the question is being asked, because delta G is less than zero for this reaction, is that why the reaction will automatically occur? Yes. But now that we've had thermodynamics, equilibrium, and kinetics, yes, the reaction will be spontaneous, but it still has an activation energy. So spontaneous doesn't mean it happens just like that. It means that it will happen with a release of energy, which means it will happen if it passes its activation barrier. So propane can sit around in oxygen without blowing up all by itself. If the activation energy for such a process was really low, yes, it would really blow up when it just hits oxygen. It would just start reacting. That's not the case here. So the reason I say that is because we're at the end of the quarter, we can start talking about how these ideas relate together. So I just want to make sure that you understand, not you yourself, but the whole class, that spontaneous doesn't mean fast. Spontaneous means it's thermodynamically favorable. Diamond decomposing is spontaneous. It takes thousands and thousands of years.
But for the delta G, the greater than zero, that means that this equation cannot overcome the activation, right?
No. So now backwards, when delta G is greater than zero, even if you have the activation energy, the reaction's not favorable to happen.
Okay, gotcha.
Think of a rechargeable battery. When you put the battery into a device and it's being used, delta G is negative. The battery is reacting in a way that it provides electricity, a potential. When you want to charge the battery, you can't just charge it by looking at it. You have to put it in something that forces that reaction backwards. Not, again, just in terms of activation energy. Because there's just not enough energy to force the reaction to stay backwards. Unless you add that energy in. That's what non-spontaneous means. It means regardless of how fast it would be, to make the reaction happen, you have to add energy.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Brittany.
Hi. I had a good question about something you mentioned. It was like a Chem 1A topic, but when you asked it whether it was ionic or covalent.
Yes.
I just kind of wanted a quick review on that because it makes sense, but I still want to like go through it again just to solidify it.
It's identifying the fact that the substances, or that the substance is made of 2 ions. And that's how you can identify that it is an ionic compound. So if you see KBr, K is going to be K plus, Br, Br minus. In that case, because they're on opposite sides of the periodic table, so you know you have enough electronegativity difference. Here, you don't even have to worry about electronegativity. You just know that ammonium is an ion, nitrate is an ion, and therefore this is an ionic compound.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Sure. Sean.
Just so I can kind of put it all together in my head, I feel like there's a relationship between exothermic and endothermic being similar to endogonic and exergonic. Is that true?
The relationship is that exo means a release in both cases and endo means absorb in both cases. But the difference between endothermic and endergonic is that endothermic means that you're absorbing heat. Endergonic means either you're absorbing heat or you're making order. And it doesn't necessarily say which one of those things is happening. In other words, you have to add potential energy. Potential energy can be distributed in the form of entropy and enthalpy. So that's why it's different than just the term enthalpy itself.
Okay. And then my last question is about order, actually.
Yeah.
When you say order and disorder, what exactly does that mean? Like, I know that obviously one is like, you know, chaos and the other one's like, you know, put together well, but how does that apply to?
So one way to think about it is think of a solid versus a liquid. When a solid turns into a liquid, suddenly its molecules are able to tumble around in all kinds of ways they never were before. And then if you take that liquid and go back to a solid, then the molecules get arranged in a way that constrains their possible modes of motion, which is just like saying statistically, you're going to ignore all these possible cases of it moving around, and somehow you're going to only limit it to this few. That's the one way, that's the one detail that I can't come up with the intuitive way of explaining. That's why it involves an energy change, but it does. That when you somehow restrict the motion of these molecules, you decrease their entropy, that essentially costs energy.
Maybe because it takes more energy to organize things?
Well, that's the way I rationalize it. I don't know if that works out well to say it in theory, but essentially, yes.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Sure.